When I was in third grade when they tried to assassinate Reagan, and we were at recess and we got called back and we came inside, and my teacher was named Berna Pribula. She gave us this information that the president had been shot or whatever, And she's like, "Are there any questions?" And I raised my hand, and my question was, "Are they going to play the Indiana North Carolina basketball game tonight?" Because that was the national championship. And she's like, I don't know. That was definitely not the question she expected.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, the writers Chuck Klosterman and Michael Weinreb come on the show to talk about the way sense of place is evoked in sports movies and TV shows. This is part of my ongoing investigation of how places are depicted in cinematic storytelling, which began with Kansas Never Plays Itself, my feature-length video essay about how movies mythologize and misrepresent my home state. Today's episode ties into a deleted scene from that video about how things like sports movies and popular music shape the way we see places. I've embedded that deleted scene in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. But as you'll find out, today's episode isn't a disciplined examination of sports movies and geography. It's a loose and meandering conversation about sports fandom and movie fandom and life in general that underscores why my podcast is called Deviate. This is very much in keeping with the mind of Chuck, who's one of my favorite writers and a very entertaining guest on Ringer Network podcasts like The Rewatchables, as well as Michael, who's talked about sports and movies on my podcast before. Together, the three of us talk about how sports fan bases tend to reflect the civic self-image of different parts of America. We talk about the time-honored narrative conceit that sports are a way for young people to get out of inner cities and isolated rural places. We talk about how Chuck's novel Downtown Owl was made into a movie in 2023 and the fact that the producers considered shooting it in New Mexico, even though the story is set in North Dakota. We talk about how inspirational sports movies like Rocky or Miracle might be different if they were made today. And ultimately, perhaps inevitably, our conversation devolves into a bunch of hypotheticals about how we all best like to watch sports. It begins with the three of us hypothesizing about where in Texas the town of Dillon is on the TV show Friday Night Lights. Let's listen in. Anyway, I've convened you guys today to talk about the geography of sports movies and the way that sports movies can serve as shorthand for understanding a place, or really the way that sports in general can serve as a shorthand for understanding a place. And one reason I bring this up is that one thing that I cut out of my video essay was a little tangent about representation, geographical representation in sports movies, and how rural places actually fare pretty well in sports movies, better so than normal movies. And so there's a couple of movies I was thinking of starting with, or actually a couple of places, one of which is Indiana, which seems to be the most represented sports state. I could be wrong. I welcome you guys to disagree. But maybe let's start with Friday Night Lights, the TV show, just because I spent so much time watching that, and it was sort of a window into a fictive sense of America. So what are you guys' thoughts on Friday Night Lights and what it says about life in small town Texas?
Well, was Friday Night Lights shot like in Austin? I know they're obviously the B-roll is like the shots of, did they shoot that in Texas? I assume that they did, but I don't want to talk about this and be wrong.
Right. Well, they shot it in Pflugerville, which is sort of a suburb of Austin.
Okay.
And so it's obviously the fictional town of Dillon, Texas. It's a spinoff of the movie, which is based on a nonfiction book, which was set in, do you guys remember where it was set?
The book?
Yeah.
The book was in Odessa.
Odessa.
Yeah. Odessa and Midland in that West Texas.
So, do you think that Dillon is Odessa, or is it just sort of an idealized rural Texas where people care a lot about football?
I think that it's sort of a composite idea. It's not supposed to represent Odessa, I don't think, because I think it wasn't Odessa like part of like one of like the petro dynasties, like part of like the petroleum based towns that there's like, because a lot of times, but historians of Texas high school football, they say there's the petro dynasties and then like the metro dynasties, which were all like the teams in like Dallas and Houston.
But I think,
I think that Dillon has no relationship. There's no. Nobody's in the oil industry in that, right?
I think you're wrong. I think isn't Buddy? Is he, Buddy Garrity is an oil guy.
Oh, he runs
right?
a car dealership, I thought.
Oh, that's right, he does. But yeah. I still think it's supposed to be an idealized version of West Texas rather than Metro Texas. Because remember when they go to like Dallas and they play that team? That's
but
like
is Odessa the real Odessa? Is that West Texas or is that East Texas?
That's West Texas
for sure.
East Texas is what is East Texas?
Well, East Texas is closer to Austin, closer to Dallas.
Yeah, I think this is. I think it's supposed to be a idealized version of West Texas because there's that romanticism to. I mean, you have the special relationship, the sentimental relationship with Texas football, Chuck. Yes. So you know,
I never think of Dylan actually as being like when I imagine the Texas map. I guess this is the first time I really thought to myself, like, where would it be? Like, where would it be on that map? Because you know, it's like the. So you have the book, which is like the non-fictional version of that. Then you have the film, which is like the fictional version of the non-fictional thing. And the television show is like none of the characters are involved. Everything is made up, the town and all the people. That to me seems like almost like kind of a third level of reality. I've never thought about it, I guess, as having a real, like I've never thought about where it would actually be. Like what, you know, do you remember, Michael, is there any episodes where they talk about, like, they're going to Houston, they're going to Dallas? Like, do they ever mention, like, when he goes to coach college, where is he coaching at?
I think when they go to the state championship game, it's in Dallas.
That's in Dallas, but that's where it always was for years.
Yes, and it seems like that was a long journey for them. And I don't know, I just always got this sense that the idea of the show was that it was this, like, this West Texas culture, sort of rural, removed from the rest of the world. And that's, don't you think that's kind of the romantic ideal of a lot of Texas football anyway, is that these guys kind of come from these towns in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, definitely, definitely. It's like the emotional part of the book and then just sort of refabricated in this new place. See, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, obviously, I bet if we went to the Wikipedia entry, there's probably somebody who knows like the longitude and latitude of where Dylan is supposed to be. But yeah.
Does it matter? I mean, one thing that you talk about, that one talks about when, like Texas, when you talk about Texas, I mean, it could be bayous in Houston, you know, it could be sprawl around Dallas, it could be high plains around Lubbock. But does it matter? Does it matter where Dylan, Texas is?
Well, I mean, does it matter where it actually would be, or does it matter for the consumer? I suppose the first one I would say no, the second one I would say yes. You know, just by chance, last night I was on YouTube, and do you guys remember the intro to the TV show Perfect Strangers?
Is that with Balky?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so do you remember where Perfect Strangers was set?
I'm going to guess Milwaukee, but it's probably wrong.
No, Milwaukee's like where Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley were. Okay. But you're close. It's Chicago, okay? And in the opening sequence of Perfect Strangers, they go to a Cubs game. They're like going to every sort of cliche tourist place in Chicago. Now, the show itself, in my memory, 90% of it was in their apartment.
Right.
There are no exterior shots, right? This is common. Seinfeld is the same way. That's you're shot in LA. It was weird about Seinfeld is you can almost, when they're outside, you can tell they're not in New York. The sun seems weird. Does, you know, so, but this thing with Perfect Strangers, I was thinking, it's interesting. It's like there was obviously some belief that they wanted like Cousin Larry to have like a Midwestern sensibility.
Huh.
But they didn't want the show to be somewhere where if you set any fictional thing in a real small place, then it really becomes a character. Like you have to sort of address the fact that they're in this sort of small place. I think they wanted like a big enough city where you could be sort of anonymous, where somebody like Belky could move about, I guess, and not be seen as too weird, but they weren't actually going to place it there. So like when you say like, does it matter where Dylan, Texas is? It's almost like, I think if I, you know, maybe I'm giving him too much credit for this, but it's almost like we're just going to sort of have it be an abstraction. And then the viewer will decide where he or she thinks it should be. Huh. Like like they will place it almost like Springfield on The Simpsons, where they're like they will intellectually place it in whatever is the thing that will, I don't know, give them the most pleasure. Like if they want to imagine it being really rural, they can do that. If they want to imagine it being close to Austin, they can imagine that, you know. But here again, we're just sort of talking about this. I wonder if we looked into this, if there was, like, if Peter Berg or whatever had a more specific idea of where this was supposed to be.
Don't you think everything about it was kind of built around the idea of, like, being in a small town and this rural high school football team that's kind of the center of the town? It just felt to me like it had to be somewhere way out of a city.
Well, but this is, but here again, this is all sort of, we kind of project our own experience. Like, to me, it doesn't seem that rural. Like, it seems enormous, like, you know? Like, it doesn't,
maybe because bigger, of where you grew
much
up.
Much bigger than my town. Yeah. Whereas, like, in Hoosiers takes great lengths to make it seem as though this is a town of less than 1,000 people. Huh. Like, there's, like, they, like, you know, everything that, every time you see any B-roll in Hoosiers, it looks desolate. There's no one around. The gyms look old and things. And so, so when I, like, to me, what do we assume the population of Dillon is?
I was just going to ask that. I know that there's one high school, and then suddenly there's another high school.
Yeah, well, there, yes. and there's obviously some kind of racial divide in the town. The town's big enough that there's one community that's mostly black. So I assume, okay, well, let me give you your guesses first of what the population of Dillon is supposed to be.
Michael, you go first. I have definite things about this because I live near a town of about, with two high schools. So Michael,
I think there's an interesting thing here. I think when they wrote the pilot and maybe in the early episodes, it was a very small town of a few thousand people. Then when they started to build out the story, they were like, let's do this other high school. Let's do this black neighborhood and talk more about the racial things as the show moved on. So then it became a town of like 20,000 people. Well, so I think it kind of morphed over time.
So how, Michael, maybe both of these. Okay, what was the population of Maslin, Ohio?
Maslin, Ohio?
Yeah.
I don't remember. What it was.
Maslin's population was 32,000. Their football stadium could hold 16,000. So when you see in the very, I think in the first episode of Friday Night Lights, it's so weird. We're talking about this like we couldn't check. If we could easily check, we could have just fucking watched it. But it's like, I feel like they show the stadium. And I think that's the kind of stadium where you would have to have at least 25,000 people in town to have a stadium like that. Now, maybe the idea is they're supposed to, you know, trying to point out the dichotomy of the fact that, like in Maslin, it is strange that this football stadium's half as big as the whole town or whatever, you know. But because it's a TV show, if there was, like, nobody ever says anything like, here, you're welcome to Dillon. It's crazy. The football stadium is bigger than the whole town. Or like, nobody says anything like that. So I guess I assume that there was 25,000 people in Dillon, but I don't know.
It could be as many as 40, but I think 25 could be safe. I think 25 could fit two high schools. I live near a town of about 40,000 that has two high schools, but they're 6A schools. So they're like the biggest level of high school. So I think certainly a town of 20, 25,000 people could have two mid-sized high schools in it. But then also it brings up the question, like, of the people that live there. And I think one thing that the TV show, maybe one reason why the TV show is appealing is that the people there are a little bit too good looking and cool to maybe be in your average 20,000 people Texas town. They're sort of a Brooklyn name.
Well, sure. I mean, like, okay. Like, yes, that high school would have some of the most attractive girls. It would be insane. But, like, so did Bayside High School, like, you know, on Saved by the Bell. Like, you assume a fictional high school is going to have more attractive people than a real high school. You almost have to look beyond that, right? Like, you can't... I think that when you're talking about things on television and particularly, and you're talking about like verisimilitude and realism, you can't use they're too attractive as a criticism because there are very few programs where that would not
apply. Especially shows that are set around a high school. It feels like there are always good looking people.
Yes.
Well, then let's change this a little bit. What makes it Texas? What's the Texasness of Friday Night? Besides the fact that they say Texas forever, they go to church. What are some other things that makes it a Texas show?
I think Buddy Garrity, the car salesman, is kind of the most, in some ways, he's like the most Texas character of them all, because he's sort of this huckster who's around the football team and is always trying to do the wrong thing, and he's a booster who has no morals for a lot of the show. Then eventually he kind of develops more of a character and becomes more moralistic. But to me, he always felt like kind of the epitome of like this small town Texas football boy. This is the only thing that mattered to him, and he was going to spend all his money on this and spend all his time on this. Those were sort of the things that stood out to me.
The thing I always thought about was the Jesse Plemons character, because in the first episode particularly, now this of course changes as the series goes on, but initially he is kind of created as the person who doesn't play football, doesn't like football, wants to be in like this death metal band or whatever, and yet football seems to completely dictate and control his reality and his life. And to me, that is the thing that is, like, if someone said, like, what's the most meaningful thing about Friday Night Lights, book, movie, film, all of these things? It's sort of the idea that there are places, and Texas seems to have the most of them, where football is so omnipresent that it imbues the lives of everyone, including and perhaps especially the people who view themselves as opposed to it. Where, like, it's not really something you can like it or you can hate it, but you can't not care.
Let's zoom out a little bit to other sports movies that are sort of evocative of place. Like, were there any sports movies that sort of captured your imagination when you guys were younger? And sort of a window on the rest of the world? Because I mentioned Indiana early on, and I had friends who were obsessed with Breaking Away. Rudy came along a little bit after that. But then there's Hoosiers. Actually, I was telling Michael when we were talking about your book, Chuck, that when my wife was asking me who was in the NCAA national championship, she doesn't care about sports, I said, well, it's Miami and the Indiana Hoosiers. And she's like, no, not basketball, the football game. Who's playing in the championship? I'm like, the Hoosiers and the Hurricanes. And she's like, I thought the Hoosiers were a basketball team. So I think that movie has so suffused the culture that my very intelligent wife just assumes that Hoosiers is a basketball reference and doesn't apply to it.
But if somebody had told me 5 years ago the national championship was going to be Indiana and Miami, I would have been like, I'm surprised Miami made the national championship for basketball.
Right, right.
I would have never thought that was the football. I mean, I would have never thought that. I've talked about this with Michael, and I've talked about this. Like, everybody knew that, like, one NIL team or portal team was going to succeed. I would have never thought it was that. I would have never guessed that, you know?
Well, did you grow up, Chuck or Michael, with an understanding of Indiana as a basketball state? I mean,
for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
if I had been the best basketball player in the country, I am 100% certain I would have been Indiana.
This guy will argue in favor of Bob Knight. In fact, you did argue in favor of Bob Knight for a long time until he finally got fired. But there is I was just looking back. Because it's been 50 years since Indiana basketball team went undefeated and won the national championship. And they were the last team to do that. Yeah, and it's just interesting to look back on the way those Bob Knight teams were romanticized, but also people realize, like, this guy's a real problematic individual, but he's winning a lot of basketball games, and the entire state seems to love him and seems to subscribe to this ethos of his, where, you know, and I think, Chuck, you kind of grew up.
No, see, I love Season on the Brink. Season on the Brink is the only book I've ever done this to. I can vividly remember this. I was in my chemistry class reading it, because I was just sitting back there reading it, and I got to the last page and finished it, and then just went back to the front and read it again. Like, there was no break. I just reread the book the way, you know. So reading like Damon Bailey as an eighth grader, so that was like a huge thing. In fact, when I was in third grade, when they tried to assassinate Reagan, and we were at recess and we got called back, and we came inside, and my teacher was named Berna Pribula. She gave us this information that the president had been shot or whatever, you know. And she's like, are there any questions? And I raised my hand, and my question was, are they going to play the Indiana-North Carolina basketball game tonight? Because that was the national championship. And she's like, I don't know. That was definitely not the question she expected. So I guess, yes, there was never a time in my life, I don't think, where I didn't associate Indiana with basketball. It's probably the main thing I associated with Indiana my whole life. You know?
Well, like Bobby Knight versus Gene Hackman, because I sort of grew up with more of a Gene Hackman understanding of Indiana basketball, maybe because I was in Kansas and Kansas has its own rival understanding of what's important in the world of basketball. Michael, are you more Gene Hackman or more Bobby? Probably more Bobby Knight, I'd reckon.
In terms of like
how you understand the state, like when you think of Indiana basketball, do you think of the boys of Hickory High playing in an old fashioned gym, or do you think of Bobby Knight throwing a chair across the room and winning a couple national championships?
Well, aren't they kind of intertwined? I mean, isn't the Gene Hackman character basically Bobby Knight if he kind of grew a conscience toward the end of his career? I feel like they're kind of the same person, so I sort of just tie them together now. I don't really think of them as separate characters that much. I just sort of see them as kind of two extensions of the same persona of this sort of hardcore martial coach, which is, you know, I feel like, Chuck, that's something that you're always kind of interested in, that idea of that kind of coach.
Was Gene Hackman, though, was he mean?
He punched a guy. Isn't that why he got fired? That's right.
So he was almost the Woody Hayes character. He was like a Woody, was he a college coach who punched a player? Now he's a coach high school.
Yeah, but I think he's kind of a Bobby Knight / Woody Hayes.
And like we're practicing with all basketballs, that kind of thing.
Exactly. We're going to pass the ball 18 times before we shoot, you know. It felt like they were kind of the same person.
Well, here's a question in terms of sports and generations, is that we're all about the same age, I think. But is there someone who's like a millennial who doesn't really remember Hoosiers, but remembers Rudy, you know, which was a little bit later in the pop culture cycle and would think of Indiana as a football state?
Well, Notre Dame sort of exists, though, in such a national way. I don't think people think of Notre Dame football as really being like something that comes from Indiana. I think they probably see it to some degree as being Midwestern, sort of maybe in like ideology or whatever. But like Notre Dame is like the one, I would say, truly like national college football team. And that it seems like it's likely that you're going to meet a fan of that team in Portland as you are in Indianapolis.
I would argue that Notre Dame is as associated with New York City as it is with Indiana. Mm. Yeah. Because of all the Subway alumni.
Yeah.
Subway alumni?
Oh, you're not familiar? Yeah, so Subway alumni is the term that they use for New York City people who were Catholics who became Notre Dame fans, and that kind of became their fan base. You know, they would play a lot of games in and around New York City. They would play Army every year.
They still try to get him in that Pinstripe Bowl when they can.
They still have a huge fan base in New York City just because of the Catholic thing.
It's interesting about like a metropole like New York City, fandom there. I have a specific story of the time that Wichita State made the Final Four. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to New York, there's like 10 different sports bars where you could watch KU Jayhawks games. I could not find a sports bar to watch Wichita State play, I forget who it was, Syracuse or somebody, in the Final Four. And eventually it was like some Australian sports bar in Midtown or something. And so I'm wondering if there's other placeless sports franchises. If Notre Dame is sort of America's team of college football, I mean, that raises the question, was Dallas ever America's team truly? I mean, I think, Chuck, you and I for sure were Dallas Cowboy fans as a kid, mm-hmm. You know, sort of tied into, you know, the Roger Staubach, Tom Landry-ness of that franchise. Like, but I've met a lot of Green Bay Packers fans all over America.
And the Steelers have a large fan base, although the Steelers are all like Green Bay and Pittsburgh are just like, they're almost like beloved in those communities in a way that it does seem to like really kind of tether them there. Where the Cowboys are slightly different, in the sense that they're, of course, yes, the most popular team in Texas for sure. But in Texas, there is sort of this built-in belief that the high school football is the most important thing. So like the high school team is the most popular team in a lot of towns, I would guess.
Well, I don't know if it was this way for you guys when you were younger, but I sort of learned geography from pro sports. And so I just assumed Green Bay was a major American city, you know, that it was just a shorthand. Did you guys have a similar relationship to?
There were many places I only knew about because of sports. Syracuse. I had no idea anything about Syracuse except for their basketball team. I don't think I knew one other thing about them. I was kind of shocked when I found out that people like Lou Reed went to college there. That was like real weird to me. I was like, I never thought of it. I didn't think of anybody but like Derek Coleman going there.
Did you know it was in New York?
I don't know. I don't know if I did. That's a great question.
I think I told you this last time, Ralph, but I always thought watching college football that Auburn was a state. I always thought that like they were part of the SEC. I just assume it was like Arkansas was next to Auburn, was next to Alabama, and that there were three different states, you know?
Did you guys know where Notre Dame was? Because I don't think I knew it was in Indiana until I was a teenager.
I knew it was in South Bend, Indiana. For some reason, I think that because I bet you did this, and I know Michael did. I used to read a lot of like kids' books about football, and the likelihood that there was a story about Notre Dame in those books was extraordinarily high. Like there was always a story about Newt Rockne, or so you know. So I did know that it was in South Bend, Indiana, but that would have been, I mean, if somebody said, well, like where, what else is in Indiana? Like I would have said, well, Indianapolis. I don't know if I like, you know, although there was, this is a weird thing, but there was this, I was a little kid. My dad used to always watch PBS and there was a show about Muncie, Indiana and their basketball rivalry with another high school. I guess this is kind of famous because I've brought it up before and other people know what I'm talking about. But it almost had a Friday Night Lights appeal kind of. Because it was this town of Muncie, Indiana, and they had a local rival, you know, like a different town. And there was a whole like a TV series about these towns kind of based around this. So I guess I did. Maybe that's also part of the reason I associate basketball in Indiana, like in such a kind of irretractable way. Like I still think it's the main thing I think about Indiana in general is basketball. It's the main thing I think about when I think of that state.
I'm curious if there's any stories, like if, I don't think there's a great North Dakota sports movie, and I'm not sure if there's a great state college sports movie. I mean, there's Paterno, which...
The fish is still in Pittsburgh.
Oh, well, that's Pittsburgh. This isn't Pittsburgh. No,
well, I think you're talking about Pennsylvania as a whole.
Pennsylvania as a whole, there's plenty. There's Rocky, obviously, but...
I guess that's true.
But in terms of state, there is a movie that I have never seen... That is about John Cappelletti, who won the Heisman Trophy in like the 1973 for Penn State. His brother was dying at the time when he was having this amazing season. And then he gave a speech at the Heisman Trophy about his brother. And then they made a movie about it called Something for Joey, which was based on a book, which I have never seen. And I've never read the book, weirdly enough. And I don't know, my guess is they didn't film it in State College, but I don't really know. It's weird that I haven't seen that. And I, for you know, reasons of not really wanting to watch it, but nothing personal against your wife, I haven't seen Paterno either, you know?
Right. Actually, I may not have seen Paterno. No, I saw Paterno. Before I met my wife, I saw Paterno. I had no idea who this person was. Chuck, my wife is an actor, and she played one of the moms of the victims in Paterno.
Oh, really?
So when I brought this up with Michael before, he's like, yeah, that traumatized me. I don't want to talk about it. Given your geographies, though, like, Chuck, I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure you once wrote an article about a Native American basketball team and two guys fouled out and they beat the other team with three people. I mean, like, if you were to make a sports movie about North Dakota, would it be about that? Or, like, what do you think, what is the landscape of North Dakota?
Well, I mean, that actually, okay, so I believe that school, you know, like, I mean, yes, in some ways that would be a great situation to make a movie out of. But of course, it would become less about the sport. That situation would certainly become about, if you made a movie about it, sort of the dichotomy between this Native American college where they had no resources whatsoever, you know, and it would be strange then because of the other team was the Botno School of Forestry, which I guess would be like the evil villain in this. But yet, in the grand scheme of colleges, they'd probably change that into a college. They'd probably make it to like a religious school or something. That would be Because with sports movies in general, it really can't just be about the sport. It's very rare when that happens. It always has to be about something else. It's always good. You know, that's like, what's the biggest compliment that a sports book gets? It's like someone's like, this isn't really about sports at all, which is always troubling to me, which is part of the reason why I liked Seasons on the Brink so much. That book was about basketball in a way that Friday Night Lights is not just about football. Like, somebody who doesn't like football at all could enjoy Friday Night Lights. I can't imagine somebody who doesn't like basketball at all enjoying Seasons on the Brink. So if, like, the idea of if a movie was made about North Dakota sports, it would be like did you guys ever see a movie as a early Ryan Gosling movie called like The Slaughter Rule?
I don't think I have.
It's like one of his very first movies, and he wants to play football. He's in this super small town, and like I believe they're playing 6-man or 8-man football. And I think it's like 6-man. It says because in Wyoming, I think it's set in Wyoming. But that whole movie kind of becomes this idea mostly about like, well, I'm in this place. Can I get out of this place? I don't want to be here. This is so weird. It's like, I'm the only person. You know, I think if you made a sports movie about North Dakota, that would almost certainly be the underlying tone. This is like an isolated place. And it's like, can I escape from there? Can I escape from this place? You know, that was the same way with lots of, like when you're watching Hoop Dreams or whatever, you know, there is always this message that like basketball can possibly save these guys. And by saving, it means get them out of here. Even though the one who does kind of make it, like his life isn't that terrible. It's the other kid who's got the tough life and he never really, you know, kind of escapes it, I guess. But yeah.
Have you ever thought of writing or pitching a sports movie, Chuck?
Not really. I mean, thought about it. Maybe I thought about it, but I don't know how to do it. I'm not saying it would be something I couldn't possibly do, but it would be something I would have to figure out and try. And I'm sure it's not as easy. I'm sure it's not easy, you know? And it seems like as long as I can do this thing, I should keep doing it until I can't, you know, the other thing.
So they made a movie out of your novel.
Yes.
The Downtown Owl, which is about growing up in North Dakota. And it was kind of an indie movie. I actually haven't seen it, but is there a football coach in it? Isn't there a football coach in it?
The football coach is a pretty insignificant character. The person in the movie does not seem like a football coach. I mean, like, there was just that movie. The people who made it were great. I mean, just wonderful people. They spent 13 years trying to make that a movie, and they finally achieved that at the end. But they had just no budget at all. And as a consequence, it just does not work. It does not really reflect the book. It tries too hard or whatever. So yeah, so like I think you could make a movie based just on the football coach's story as it is in the book. And that would be kind of an interesting sports movie. But, you know, I think sports movies in general are hard to do well. Like if somebody asked me to list my 10 favorite sports movies, like it would be hard to come up with 10 that like both that I like and feel confident saying like, this is a good movie. Like, I mean, is The Program a good movie? I guess I did like it, but I know it was very inspired you in a lot of ways and your friends to Lie in the Road, but it's like.
Actually, I get the reference more than I do the title of that movie. I remember that line.
That was like the only part of the movie that anybody ever remembers is these guys lying down in the road.
Which isn't even in the movie, right? Didn't they remove it?
I think they took it out. It was kind of that era of like Two Live Crew and like where things would just get, the song Cop Killer would just get taken off the album. You know, it was like the same thing.
Back when we were little literalists in the 1990s. Well, Michael, I know that you have a TV pilot called QB1, and I want to ask you about that in a second. But to me, it feels like certain historical situations feel very cinematic. Like when I found out that in my hometown of Wichita, Kansas, in 1925, a black team called the Wichita Monrovians played a Ku Klux Klan all-star team and won, right? There's not that many details about it, but I wrote a script about it. It'll probably never get made just because it's like, oh, the sports movie can sort of play out the civil rights drama at the time.
It was a Ku Klux Klan all-star game. Okay. So they went to the various Ku Klux Klan. It was like, who's your best guy? I mean, like, put it together. It's like, I didn't know there'd be all.
Well, see,
it'd be very easy for the KKK to have ringers because they were in the woods. So, like, you know, they could just have been brought in Jack Sigma. So he's a case.
Do you think they wear the hoods on the court?
But actually, that's spoken like a journalist, Chuck. Actually, I don't know if it was an all-star team, but it sounds better if they're an all-star team. That basically, they were just the local. It was a time when they were trying to expand the Ku Klux Klan into the Midwest, and it was sort of a scam. It was just sort of a.
But the KKK starts in Indiana, so didn't they already have some? Or are they trying to go further, like in the Minnesota?
They were organized in Georgia, but they were very successful in Indiana. There was actually some infamous lynchings in Indiana during that time, and there was a lot of legislators in Indiana who were Ku Klux Klan members. And actually, the gubernatorial election in 1924, this is all in my script, guys. In 1924, the Democrat and the Republican refused to condemn the Ku Klux Klan because they wanted the votes of people who decided to become a Ku Klux Klan. But they were sort of selling themselves as like a Kiwanis Club, but with racism type thing. And I think people were really interested in the secret society aspect of this. Anyway, not that many details are known about the game, including Chuck, I'll admit. I don't know if it was an all-star team, but in my mind, it was an all-star team. And so they played, we know the final score, but that's about it. And so I sort of filled in the blanks. And so I feel like you could almost fill in the blanks of that basketball game, you know, and just sort of find these kids who've had tough lives and need a win or something. But actually, it sounds like it's sort of the inversion. You say sports movies, not that I've written a movie that's been produced, but it feels like sports movies lend towards certain kinds of human drama in ways that maybe an average based on a true story event wouldn't. But I could be wrong. Do you want to be the tiebreaker, Michael?
In terms of sports, so the question is, do sports movies...
Can you take a historical sporting event like the 3-on-5 basketball game that Chuck saw, or the Ku Klux Klan game that I read about in the 1920s, does it lend itself easily to making a movie, or is it trickier than it sounds?
It's probably trickier than it sounds, but mostly because it could wind up just being a cliche. Because most sports movies are cliched. Even the good ones, like Hoosiers, is kind of cliched in the way that it's structured. And that's why the ones that I tend to like are the ones that aren't cliched. See, Chuck and I differ on this. Whereas I actually like a sports book or a sports movie that isn't about sports. That's kind of what I want.
One of the things you mentioned earlier, it is like, okay, so the movie Vision Quest.
The wrestling movie.
I remember there being a lot of scenes in that movie of like a guy out running in the morning, like running over bridges. And like, I think it's weirdly, but the music is by Madonna. But like he's running and he's like training. But I don't know where that movie is set. It looks like it's set in the same place All the Right Moves was set. And I know that was Pennsylvania, right?
That was outside of Pittsburgh, I think.
And that's, yes, you know. And that's like, when I saw Vision Quest, I remember thinking like, it looks like this is the same place, but I don't remember if there's any, like sometimes there'll be a movie like that that has a sense of place without the place actually being described. And I think that's even the other one of the most, or it's described in passing. And then like you have an image like, well, like a, well, like Downtown Owl, they almost shot that in New Mexico. I convinced them not to, but they were going to, there were all these tax breaks or whatever. And they were like, I will be, it will net, there's no place that's going to look like North Dakota in New Mexico.
Doesn't a blizzard figure in Downtown Owl?
Yes. Yeah. That's part of the problem because the blizzard's the key part of that book and the blizzard looks completely unrealistic in this movie. So I say to them after I see it, I was like, it doesn't really look like, you know, it doesn't really look like a blizzard. And they're like, well, you know what it costs to make a realistic blizzard in a movie? And I was like, what? And they were like, $400,000. Do you know what the budget for this movie was? $400,000. So they're like, we would have made a realistic blizzard. That's all it would have been. There'd been no people in it.
It would have been an hour, 45 minutes of just a blizzard.
It's a Downtown Owl is an art film. I'm curious, Michael, if like Oakland as a city with a bad reputation, And in one of your recent Substacks, you said, "I've never seen a city take more abuse from people who've never set foot in it than Oakland. I've never seen a city blamed more for losing sports teams whose owners simply chose greed over civic pride." I mean, we're talking about mediation of places, be it through sports franchises or sports movies. Why does Oakland have a bad reputation?
I think a lot of it is racism that goes back to the 60s and 70s when it was a very black city and people associate it with crime, people associate it with the Black Panthers. So I think all that carried over. I think that there's also, you have San Francisco right across the bay, and San Francisco just has the opposite reputation as sort of this gilded city, the beautiful city. And Oakland was always sort of the working class place. That's where the port is, you know. And the sports teams were kind of the living representation of that until they all left town. But, you know, like the Raiders, like that's Oakland. You know, you think about like, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, like hanging around with Hell's Angels. That's Oakland, you know. You think of the A's and like this dingy old stadium, you know, and that's kind of what Oakland was, and that's kind of what its reputation was. And now it's obviously, it's sort of like, I think Portland has some similarities, because I think one of the best documentaries I've seen in recent years was that one about the baseball team
in Portland. Battered Bastards of Baseball.
Battered Bastards of Baseball was just this great documentary about Portland in the 70s when it was just kind of this working class lumberjack town. And they just had this minor league baseball team that was, you know, like Kurt Russell's dad was the owner of it, I think. I mean, it's just, it was the kind of the same thing where it was just very much this working class town that's now kind of turned into this gentrified place, but it's still sort of associated with what it used to be in a lot of ways.
Well, that ties into the first wave of grunge too, because I remember, you know, when I lived near Portland, it was in the early 90s, and Portland was seen as this sort of authentic place, sort of this working class town where you would go to the Satyricon and people would be doing drugs outside. And I was there with my Christian college friends from Newburgh, Oregon. And so I just wonder if, like, how much of reputation... The reason I bring this up is that the first Chiefs game I ever went to, Kansas City Chiefs, was against the Oakland Raiders. And it was as if they had emptied a prison bus. Like everybody who was wearing an Oakland Raiders uniform was a performative, like, thug or something. And I don't mean in the racialized sense, but like face tattoos and threatening people sort of thing. It's almost like the ethos of the Raiders goes beyond geography. It's maybe about actual working class authenticity, but about just sort of this toughness that ties into that.
There was an aspect of that in Cleveland, I felt too. Like the dog pound, the one end zone of the Cleveland Stadium seemed to kind of then become to represent what the Cleveland fan base was like. In that same way that I think that it, you know, it's that will happen. Yeah.
I think that's like even when you're talking about Cleveland, Major League, I mean, the Charlie Sheen character is kind of like the example of that. Like, that's kind of especially like the guy who wrote that movie and directed it is from Cleveland. And he just basically said he wanted to write a movie that would be about the Indians winning the World Series. But you watch like the first 3 minutes of it, and it's that Randy Newman song about the lake catching on fire. And there's all these scenes of just like working class Cleveland. And it really sets the scene really well. Like, it's the movie, like, you know, it's pretty broad and kind of silly at times. But like the first 5 minutes of that movie are amazing. It's really great.
I went to Cleveland once. I was driving home from driving my nephew to college in Vermont. And I stopped to watch the Royals play the Indians. And I was sitting in a bar, and everything I said to the guys at the bar was wrong. Because I went to the Rock Hall of Fame. Of course I went to the Rock Hall of Fame when I was there. And so I mentioned that I'd been there, and just these guys in sort of this working class Cleveland bar, just they had no respect for the Rock Hall of Fame, which makes sense. I interviewed Ian MacKay once, and he's not interested in the Rock Hall of Fame either. But I brought up the fact that the river caught on fire, and they were so mad. They're like, that happened in the 1960s or something.
They hate that. They fucking hate that. Yeah. it's a funny thing. And it's hard not to bring it up, but they really hate that. Yeah.
Well, that's Chuck and I's first. That's how Chuck and I met, is that we were both working at the paper in Akron, Ohio. So I feel like we kind of had a very up close and personal view of Cleveland sports as two people who don't really care either way about Cleveland sports. So I think we sort of saw the ridiculousness of it too.
Well, I mean, Ohio is, I guess you'd say, a good sports state, right? It's like they like, if someone said like name states that like sports a lot, especially like if you think of it in a Catholic way, like all sports, I think Ohio has got to be right up there. I can't, what would be better? I mean, because they're like, you know.
Yeah, maybe nothing.
Yeah, so like they're very committed to it. And they also have like, I mean, Ohio is just an interesting place in lots of ways. Like Cleveland kind of thinks of itself as an East Coast city with a rivalry with Boston. You know, like Cincinnati is the South. If you go to the West, it really is like rural. Toledo to the North is like, that's like an industrial place. I can see why it's like, it's a good kind of bellwether for the country as a whole, because it almost seems like a small version of America jammed in there. But they also feel very victimized that they look at their sports franchises as like incredibly doomed, you know?
We were talking earlier about there's sort of a placelessness to Dillon, Texas and Friday Night Lights, and we couldn't agree on where it was. Could Friday Night Lights be in Ohio? Like, could there be a generic Ohio backdrop, given what you just said about how the different regions, you know, belong to different parts of America?
I think it could, but I feel like place would matter less. Like, for a high school football thing, it's almost got to be in Texas, I feel like.
Well, Chuck mentioned, you mentioned Massillon, Ohio. I mean, that was kind of the original Friday Night Lights place.
But one thing I remember when I moved to Akron and they would tell me about Massillon, they would say like, oh, we have this, you know, they're often the thing they would say to me is that that's as crazy as Texas. Like they would use, that was still the example that this is how insane Massillon is like. It's almost like being in Texas. I suppose in some ways it is a cliche to just say it's got to be in Texas, but it's like if Hoosiers was called, you know, Gophers. It was set in a tiny, you know, Minnesota had a one-class basketball system forever. Indiana even went longer, but like in Minnesota, it was still one class up into the 1980, I think. So you could have had a very similar, like there are definitely small towns in Minnesota who have like miraculously won the state, but it would be different. It wouldn't be about like when you put it in Indiana and you call it Hoosiers, you're almost saying like this is the fucking genetic bedrock of basketball. And it's the same way with football in Texas. It's like this is where, like if you were doing it with baseball, Field of Dreams is in Iowa, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, I don't really associate that as a bit. I mean, would it be Brooklyn you'd put it in? Like what's like ground zero for baseball, not counting Cooperstown?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, because baseball has sort of faded in cultural significance. I mean, people aren't as...
I mean, I guess it would be Yankee Stadium. I guess it would be the Bronx. But I don't know. That is a good question.
Because if baseball does not have that sort of rural relationship that other sports do.
Oh, or maybe it would be Fenway Park. I mean, they did.
Yeah.
You know, Fever Pitch, when they did the American version of Fever Pitch, it was in Boston.
I have a random question about Indianapolis. I don't know if you guys have spent much time there, but it feels like the most placeless place in America. Like it really doesn't feel that distinctive. Am I just being mean because I...
I gave a talk at Butler there. It is kind of that way. It is sort of like... There's certain towns like this. Columbus, Ohio is like this. In a weird way, Denver is like this, where it almost sort of seems like a city that was made for a film or a TV show, and they wanted it to be like consciously generic almost. Like they didn't want people to be like, oh, that's New York or oh, that's Miami or whatever. Like it has a sense of like, this is just like an unnamed US city almost, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's what I was getting at. There's something about, I don't know why, and again, I apologize for my Indianapolis listeners. It just feels like every time I've been to Indianapolis, it feels like I'm not really in any place distinctive.
Yeah, I never figured out that city either. It's like their most famous thing is like a restaurant that serves a shrimp cocktail, which, you know, doesn't seem like it's that distinctive to me. So
what restaurant is that?
It's called like St. Elmo's or something. And it's apparently where everybody goes, like during the combine week, they all go there and get drunk. And then Jerry Jones gets drunk at the bar and buys everybody drinks or something.
They all
the combine used to be a big part. That was kind of the big party. Like that's where everybody would kind of come to, you know, the off season and
get drunk, sure,
and stuff like that. I don't know if it's still like that or not, but that's the way it used to be.
This sounds awful. And actually, I'm sorry if you guys love the combine, but Michael, you wrote about going to the Super Bowl this year, and that sounded sort of awful too.
You're sitting in the press box, can't hear anything. There's the windows don't open at that the stadium in Santa Clara, which is like took me an hour and a half to get to from my home in Oakland. The crowd is not like a normal football crowd.
Yeah.
They don't really care. Chuck's been to Chuck. You went to at least once.
Yeah, I went to the one in Detroit. Yeah.
And it just doesn't, it's not a normal football game.
It isn't. It's the only normal part of it is the literal game itself, like what's happening on the field. It's like they do all this stuff to kind of make it into this holiday event. All this weird ass shit that you're seeing, like just weird stuff, you know, all week long. And they have the media day where it's like, you know, every player is out there, and these guys who've never been interviewed all season now have 20 guys around them. And this all goes on. And then on the last Sunday, like a football game breaks out in the middle of this place that nobody really cares that much about. Like, in a sense, everyone cares about it. It's the biggest game of the year. But the audience is mostly just people who, like, are going to a Super Bowl.
I had that weird thing this year where I think I might have even texted you, Chuck. Because I couldn't tell if this was a terrible game or if I was just having this weird experience of watching it through like a glass window where I couldn't hear anything. So it seemed terrible. And then eventually I realized this is just a terrible Super Bowl.
I mean, I feel it's like when you're watching a game in a press box like that, and if you can't hear, if you're kind of by yourself, sometimes it's hard to tell if the game is good or bad. It's like you just like,
no, exactly. I didn't
realize
know. Yeah.
How much you're impacted by like the announcers, how over aggressively they're selling you the game. That's like it's almost like you were like, well, maybe this is like you could I can always almost find yourself saying like, maybe this is a classic game, but it seems boring, or you don't really know. You know, sometimes it drives me crazy how much effort I put into seeing sporting events, and then I don't remember anything about them 2 days later. Like, I'll move my whole schedule around to see like some Sun Belt football game, and then it's like nothing will happen or whatever, you know. But then the ones you do remember, they can compensate for like 5,000 games you forgot about. Like that's enough to make you watch 5,000 more games. Kind of like when they say like in golf, like golf's a terrible experience, but like you get one great shot, you can play for two more years. It feels so good. I don't know. I've never done it, so I guess.
And there's like a feeling to watching that stuff live, that like. It's like if you watch it on social media or something like that,
yeah, it's not
the same.
Because I mean, that's like, you know, there's so few things in all of the world that are truly unknown. Like you're watching the Academy Awards. We don't know who won Best Picture, but somebody does. Somebody wrote that, you know, sports are the rare time when like no one knows. No one knows what's going to happen in these last 4 seconds. You know, it's like, and like we're and. It's kind of a bummer sometimes to think about the 7 second delay that we have just from the nature of television, because then it's like, I guess some people did know for 3 seconds, you know, but you know, so,
that happens. Yeah. That happens sometimes when we're watching games.
Yes,
and my TV is ahead of your TV, you know,
somebody's on TV and like somebody's on their phone, you know, and the phone is slightly ahead always, you know?
So I'm curious, Michael, as a guy who Chuck says that you would, your favorite Nittany Lions game would be 60-0 and 40-0 at halftime. If you were put into a situation where you were watching the Nittany Lions play, would you rather have the guaranteed 60-0 victory or a super close possible Fiesta Bowl triumph or loss that wasn't certain?
Is it a championship game?
It's a championship game.
And then I'll take my chances on the championship game for sure. You know,
well, you wouldn't take the blowout.
Well, because if we're in a championship game, then we're in a championship game, and I'd rather get to that point. I mean, Penn State hasn't been to a championship game in 30 years.
The national championship. It's like Penn State is playing Ohio State in the national title.
Right.
Whether it come down to the last play and there's a 50-50 chance you'll win or lose, or Penn State would win 64-0.
Oh, I'll take 64-0.
I knew it. Yeah.
In that case, yeah. I mean, why sweat it?
I mean, Chuck, are you interested in 64-0 games at all as a non-fan, or are you into just the drama and the aesthetic and the narrative?
Well, you know, I have a rooting interest in every game I watch, you know? So, but I'm typically rooting for whoever is behind, which often, of course, leads me to, like, at the end of the game being unhappy or whatever. But sometimes when I watch, say, North Dakota State games, I do just want them to win. And I don't want it to be close, necessarily. I want them to be in control of the game. But that is kind of rare, and in a weird way, and maybe it's even weirder to have this feeling, I feel guilty about that. I feel a degree of guilt when I'm watching something and I want the outcome to work out the way that I want. I feel like I should be able to do that. I feel like I don't feel like I like I should not, my desires should not, I don't know, I should somehow have to pay a toll of being disappointed. I don't know. I just like, I don't know. It's very, I just,
really, it really captures your whole ethos. You know,
life
is disappointment.
Well, you can't just get what you want. If you get what you want, you won't want anymore. Like, you've got to be hurt.
Oh, no, I agree. I mean, I think that's part of watching sports too, right? Is that just part of being a fan is that if you don't watch a lot of games where your team loses, then it's not very much fun when they win. So I don't know. Maybe that's your way of being a fan.
I don't know what it is. Maybe aspects of Catholicism. Maybe aspects of my own sort of self view of myself that I do sort of think that I should not be made happy by sports. I don't know. It doesn't seem like I don't feel like I deserve that, but you know.
Well, there's another book is like the religious hardwiring of sports, you know.
Oh, it is. It is hardwired. You can't change it. Yeah.
A Catholic, a Jew, and a Protestant walk into a sports bar. Well, guys, the last chance to brought another hypothetical, but we should probably get on with it.
I know my dog is like, can we go now or what?
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Chuck Klosterman and Michael Weinreb's books, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.